find someone who can make me well and keep me from an asylum.
I'd rather...
He trails off, pressing his thumb into his chin. Please, I say. His strange silence is feeding my desperation. Let me help you, I want to shout at him. I have failed you on this front for years without knowing it, so let me help you now. What do we have to lose? Before he can reply, Felicity slides down on my other side, her skirts puffed for a moment before they settle on the planking. So, she says, like we're in the middle of a conversation already, tomorrow we begin the search for Lockwood, or at least attempt to secure some sort of lodging. If we can show them a promise from the bank, even if we can't withdraw actual funds, I think we should go to Barcelona, I interrupt. Felicity pivots to face me, executing an eyebrow arch so precise it looks penciled on. Excuse me? Apparently it's very important this box is returned. And how will we travel? We've no supplies and no transport and no money. We could try and get to some of Father's. Felicity is already shaking her head. No, absolutely not. We've nothing to do with this box or the Robleses or any of it. We need to find our company and see that the box is returned to the king. It doesn't belong to the king, I say. Yes, but there's probably a good reason he had it. Perhaps it was given to him. Why give something to him in a box he couldn't open? What sort of bastard does that? He stole the box, and we should return it to its owner. And if we return it to Mateu Robles, we'll be rid of it. Get the Duke off our tail. We're no good to him if we haven't got it. Besides, if we find Lockwood now, we'll be made to go home. Perhaps not, she says. You made rather a mess of yourself at Versailles, but if we rejoin him here, he might be so impressed by our resourcefulness and so glad we survived the highwayman that he'll let you carry on. Which will absolutely not happen if we go gallivanting to Spain alone. That's going to put you on his not list for certain. I hadn't considered that. Bolting naked from the French palace seems like something my father might consider a permanent black mark upon my record, good news for the goblin. But if Lockwood would consent to let us keep travelling, going home at the end of the allotted year with Versailles as a small side note to an otherwise successful tour would significantly bolster my chances of holding on to my inheritance, as opposed to being sent home because of it. Or at least I could work the look at the horrors we went through, please don't disinherit me after such an ordeal angle. But travelling for the rest of the year isn't going to do a damn thing for Percy. He'd still be heading off to Holland at the end of it. The man who owns this box is an alchemist, I say. And if he studies the cure-all side of it, like you heard at that lecture, he might know something that could help cure Percy. If we take him his box, maybe we could trade it for that information. Her brow knits, and she looks at Percy. Is that what you want? Percy has his thumb to his mouth, chewing at the pad like he's thinking hard. My heart seizes up a bit, mostly from the frustration that he isn't entirely on my side about this. But then he says, I think Monty's right. We should take the box to Mateu Robles. It belongs to him. I nearly throw my arms around him at those words, but instead I turn to my sister. If you don't want to come, we'd be happy to drop you at the school. Term hasn't started yet. You won't even miss the first day of your social conversation class. She ignores me and instead says to Percy, Are you sure this would be a good idea for you? I think it's... I start, but she snaps. I wasn't addressing you, Henry. Then, again to Percy, she says, Are you well enough to travel? And I feel like an insensitive rake again for not thinking of that from the start. But Percy nods. I'm all right. Felicity sighs so hard her nostrils flare like his wellness has ruined her plans. Can we all agree that if we can't secure some funds, we shouldn't go? It's already an absurd journey, but to undertake it with nothing is downright foolish. We'll hardly be able to get out of the city unless we have coinage. Agreed, Percy says, then looks at me. I was hoping the question of money might be something we three could collaborate on rather than a condition of our departure. But I nod. Felicity stretches her arms behind her head, then stands. I want you to both know that in spite of the fact that I am going along, I think this is a terrible idea. Don't pretend you aren't interested in all this, I say. Alchemy seems right up your street. Medicine and alchemy are unrelated fields, she says, though she doesn't do a particularly good job of concealing said interest. Fine. Then consider your opinion noted. Fine. She winds her hair into a knot. I'm going to get some sleep before we go. Percy, do you want a hand?
No, I think I'll stay out, he says.
Good night, then. Let me know if you need anything. As Felicity disappears, picking her way across the narrow deck to the cabin, I look over at Percy again. He's still looking up at the stars, the silvery light from the moon slithering across the water and stitching his skin. In the glow of it, he looks pearled and fine, a boy fashioned from precious stones and the insides of seashells. I think we're doing the right thing, I say, sort of to Percy and sort of to myself. At least we'll know what's in the box, he says with a half-smile. Felicity's right about Lockwood, though. If we go to Spain, he'll probably send us packing as soon as we're reunited.
But maybe Mateo Robles will have something to help you, and you can come home.
And maybe he won't. You might be giving up your tour for me.
Worth it, that. I scrub my hands through my hair. Though I think it's mostly my fault we were being sent home early, so I'm sorry for that. Sorry about the box as well, that I picked it up.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you I'm ill.
I really wish you had.
He nods. I take another drink. You're my best mate, Monty, he says suddenly. And I don't want to ruin that, especially not now. I didn't tell you I was ill because I didn't want to scare you away. And if I didn't have you, if I hadn't had you for these past few years, I think I'd have lost my mind. So if things can't be the same between us, can they at least not be terrible? You're not permitted to be strange and uncomfortable around me now.
So long as you don't go falling in love with me.
I don't know why I say it. Call it battlements around my helpless heart. Percy looks away from me fast, shoulders curling up. It almost looks like a flinch, but then he says, I'll try my best. He seems like he wants to touch me, but we've both lost any sense of how men who haven't kissed each other do that. He finally taps my knee, open-palmed and short, the way we used to try and hold our hands to candle flames without being burned when we were boys. And I wonder if there will ever again be a day when it doesn't feel as though he might fly to pieces between my hands.
12. We part ways with Pascal and the grandmothers the next morning as the sun rises. Their fare has disappeared from the pier, and the first of the boats have already kicked off from their moorings and are drifting up the river, a flock of coloured swans riding the current. Percy, Felicity, and I wander the city, searching for the French Partner Institution to the Bank of England. It's hardly morning, but the sun is already beginning to cook the stones. The heat rises from them in shimmering waves. Shops have their signs flipped and their fronts open onto the pavement, displays of produce and flowers and tailored clothes spreading out. A sharp gunpowder smell rolls from a blacksmith shop along with the bell clang of the hammer. A shoeblack with a stained rag stuffed into his breeches and a ball of sticky polish rolling between his palms wolf whistles at Felicity from his perch on a coffeehouse stoop. I extend a tasteful finger to him as we pass. We find the bank on the high street. It's a classical building with a marbled interior and rows of wooden barred windows lining the perimeter, a wigged clerk behind each. The sounds of red heels and brass-tipped canes click like dice against the stone. If we don't act soon, they're going to think we're scouting the place for a robbery, Felicity says after we've spent a half of an hour in the lobby, doing what can only be termed lurking.
We could tell them the truth, Percy suggests.
Yes, but we've only one chance, she replies, and the truth is a bit too preposterous to be convincing. Alchemical puzzle boxes and all that.
I'm hardly listening to them.
I've spent most of the while we've been loitering watching the clerk at the window nearest to the door, and after close scrutiny of his last few interactions, I'm fairly certain he and I have a big thing in common. When you're a lad who enjoys getting other lads in bed,
You have to develop a rather fastidious sense for who plays the same instrument, or there's a chance you'll find yourself at the business end of a hangman's knot. And if this fellow and I had met at a bar, I would have already bought him a drink and put his fingers in my mouth. It's a great risk. I'm not so much jumping to a conclusion as vaulting haphazardly to it. But somehow, I know.
Stay here, I say.
What are you doing?
Felicity hisses at me as I start across the lobby.
Helping!
I check myself in one of the mirrors lining the hall, ruffle my hair for good measure, then stride from the atrium and straight up to the man's window. Not even a man, he's just a boy, apprenticeship age, even younger than me. He looks up when I approach, and I give him a big eyeful of the dimples that have launched a thousand ships.
Bonjour. Parlez-vous anglais?
Oui,
he replies.
May I help you?
I've a bit of an unorthodox query.
I let out a shy laugh, flip my eyes down to the floor, then back to him through my lashes. His neck goes a little red. Fan-bloody-tastic.
You see, I'm touring.
I assumed.
Oh, am I so obvious?
Well, the English.
Of course, I laugh again. The English. God, I'm so awful at French. I can only say about three things. When is supper? Can you help me? And you have lovely eyes.
Des yeux sont magnifiques.
Was that right?
Very well done. Is the last one to impress all the French girls?
Well, I was saying it to you just then. They're quite something.
I give him a moment of intense eye contact with my head tipped a little to the side. The corners of his mouth turn up and he shuffles the papers in front of him.
You had a question?
Oh, yes. Sorry, or...
Shy smile, telling pause.
Distracting.
Now he's really blushing, poor sweet thing, I think, as I lean forward on the counter and he looks very directly at my lips. Wait until you fall for the boy who can't love you back.
So, I'm on my tour and... Sorry, it's so queer. On the way down from Paris, we were robbed.
Good heavens!
Yes, it was rather harrowing. We didn't have much on us, thank God, but they took all the letters of credit my father sent with me. I know this is his bank, but I haven't got the actual papers.
He gets ahead of me a moment before I explain it.
You want to make a withdrawal against your father's name without a letter of credit?
I told you it was an unorthodox question.
I was expecting much worse.
He cracks a shy smile.
I thought you were going to ask me to dinner.
I still might, though you'd have to pay.
He laughs and I bring the dimples out to play again.
I am sorry, but I don't.
I know that as soon as the word no makes its appearance, I will have lost irreclaimable ground. So in what can only be described as a Hannibalistic maneuver, I cut him off at the pass.
I'll give you my father's name and his address in England. He should be in your ledgers, but if there's a problem, you can write to him. And he'll send funds, I know it. I'm so sorry, but I'm in such a tight spot, and I'm a long way from home, and it'll take months before my parents can send any money, and I've nowhere to go. I hardly even speak French.
I pitch my voice a little, not quite pathetic, but sympathetic, and his whole face melts like butter. I'm not good at much, but what I do well.
Sorry, this all sounds strange.
No, he says quickly. I'm so sorry you're having a hard time.
I run my thumb along my bottom lip.
I've been standing in the lobby for the last half of an hour trying to get up my courage to come in and ask. I was so afraid I'd be turned down.
Honestly, I came to you because you look the nicest. I mean, the kindest. I mean, not that you're not...
You're very nice looking, I promise. I'm not a scoundrel. I just don't know what else there is to be done. I've nothing else left.
He sucks in his cheeks, then glances down the row of clerks.
Give me your father's name and address, he says quietly. I can't give you much, but I'll do what I can.
I could have kissed him for that.
Were we not in distinctly upright society, I would have.
He disappears behind the counter, then returns with a small stack of bills.
There was a note with the account,
he says as I sign the receipt, then slides a scrap of paper across the counter to me. At the top is written an address. Then below it, in a hasty scrawl, we have secured lodging at this location and, God willing, you will meet us here. Beneath is Lockwood's signature.
As sour as I am on our bear leader, it's a relief to know that he survived the highwayman's attack. Not only that, but he's here. We could find him by the afternoon and be back on schedule. Might not even be made to go home if Felicity's theory is correct. Instead, I'm looking at weeks of rough travel with little money, and none of the comforts to which I'm accustomed, and an unknown destination waiting for us at the end of it. But also, maybe something that could keep Percy from an asylum. The clerk stamps the receipt, then asks, "Is everything all right?" "Fine." I fold the note in half and slide it back across the counter. "Could you dispose of that for me, please?" I give him another smile, and when he hands me the bills, I let our fingers overlap on purpose. He looks ready to burst with pleasure. "How did you do that?" Felicity asks as I rejoin them on the other side of the lobby and show off my spoils. "Simple," I reply, and flash her my most roguish smile. "You have your skills, and I have mine." 13. We hire horses from a man in Marseille and start along the seaside towards Spain. I'm somehow stuck with an obstinate mount that resembles less a horse and more a leggy sausage, and seems fond of ingesting my commands and then ignoring them in their entirety. He's also the hungriest horse for miles. He's far more interested in pulling up leaves along the road than walking it. I'm a good rider, but I'm not accustomed to being on a horse for much longer than the length of a hunting trip, and the roads are rough, often nothing but thin paths winding through the scrub. By our third day, I'm so bow-legged and sore that I can hardly get up at night to piss. Percy's as bad off as I, though his legs are a fair amount longer, which I'm convinced makes a difference. Felicity rides side saddles, so she's spared some of the pain, though having her with us limits our lodging options. The number of public houses and inns along the road thins the closer we get to the border, and most take only male lodgers. One night we're so desperate that we sneak her into the room after everyone else is abed. And while I'm not a particularly attentive elder brother, that has even me concerned for my sister's modesty. But she sleeps soundly between Percy and me, the blanket all the way over her head, and I'm grateful for something to fill the space that would have been there anyway. The heat is brutal, especially up against the coast, where the sunlight sits on the ocean and festers into a haze. Felicity soaks her petticoats in the sea to keep cool, and Percy and I do the same to our shirts, though they dry before we're properly chilled. I try to wet my hair once as well, but I have never in my life liked putting my head all the way under, and Percy knows it, so as soon as I get as far into the water as I intend to, he takes it upon himself to dunk me the rest of the way. When I surface, spluttering and indignant and far more put out than a nearly grown man should be over being made to go under the water, Percy's laughing like a fool. He also seems braced for retaliation, for as soon as I'm back on my feet, he bolts, kicking up the sea as he runs. I'm ready to chase him down and shove him in, but I stop. Percy stops too when he realizes I'm not after him and looks back at me, a gaze that feels partly like a challenge and partly like a question, and I wish I had a better answer. I can tell it's writ all over me, the way that the week previous I would have tackled him straight into the sea for a laugh and had no concern. Percy must know what I'm thinking because he gives me a sad smile and turns for the shore, and I know I've just proved he was right for not telling me he was ill. Somehow nothing's changed, and everything has. The coastal road turns so rough and mountainous that we reach Spain without realizing it, until we come upon the same sort of packed customs house we fought our way through in Calais. This one is considerably more of a pain in the arse, since none of us speaks any helpful language or has a passport, which isn't a dead end, but it's certainly a hindrance. In addition, we're fairly vagrant-looking, closing in on 2 weeks unwashed, unshaven, and in the same clothes as when we were ambushed outside Marseille. We've made a few feeble attempts to clean up as we went, but we're still ripe. It will be days before we can get new documents issued, so we take up residence at a border inn for travellers waiting to cross into Catalonia. The wealthy have rooms above stairs, and since we, with our few remaining sous and no Spanish coinage, are not among that number, we sleep on straw bedrolls on the common room floor. It's crowded and noisy, mostly men but a few families with children screaming their bloody lungs out. I hope sincerely that when we make it home, if we make it home, The goblin will have grown out of his wailing years.
Percy and I leave Felicity in the common room with a book borrowed from a spinster she's befriended, and together climb up onto the roof of the livery stable in the yard. The shingles have a good slant to them, and I have to wedge my feet into the gutter and pull my knees up to my chest to sit straight. Percy lies down flat, his legs dangling over the edge as he stares up at the sky. Beneath us, on the other side of the slate, I can hear the horses nickering at each other, the fresh post-mares keening to be off. We don't speak for a while. Percy seems lost in his thoughts, and I'm busy trying to roll tobacco in a scrap of Bible page torn from a manhandled copy I dug up in the common room. I could snort it straight, but to my great shame, I've never been able to take snuff without sneezing, and as futile as this effort is beginning to seem, I'd rather smoke. Once my makeshift cigar is assembled, I have to lean a rather dangerous distance over the edge of the roof to catch the tip in the grease lamp hanging above the livery door. Percy grabs the tail of my coat to keep me from falling. "What happened to your pipe?" he asks as I take the first drag, and the whole damn thing nearly collapses between my fingers. I tip my head back and blow out the smoke in a long, precious stream before I answer. "Somewhere with Lockwood and our carriage back in France. Ah, look here, I can read the scripture as I go." "Let it never be said that you aren't resourceful." I hold out the rolled tobacco to him. "Careful, it's a bit fragile." Instead of taking it, Percy puts his mouth to my fingers and takes a pull. His lips brush my skin, and a tremor goes through me, like a shadow passed over the moon, so absolute I almost shiver. Instead of doing the foolish thing it makes me want to do, which is lean in until those selfsame lips are upon mine, I catch his chin in my hand and scrub at the stubble starting to pebble it. "You're getting rather scruffy, darling." Percy blows the smoke straight into my face and I reel back, coughing. He laughs. "And you're well freckled." "No, really? God, that'll wreck my complexion." It's a petty complaint, considering how roughed up we've become over the last few weeks. We're all of us sunburnt and wind-scraped, and I know I've lost weight. My waistcoat sat snug against me when I got it tailored in Paris, and now I have to fold an inch of material to make it tight. I've got flea bites from our dodgy lodgings up and down my back, and I'm beginning to suspect some lice have taken up residence as well. The dust from travelling is starting to feel like a second skin. I hold out the tobacco again, but Percy shakes his head. "Have some more." "I don't want any." "Go on. Tobacco's good for your health." It's not the worst thing I could have said to him, but it's certainly a contender, and I feel like an ass the moment it leaves my mouth. Percy sucks in his cheeks and looks back up at the sky. "And you're worried for my health, are you?" "Should I not be?" His mouth puckers, and I feel like I've said the wrong thing yet again for no reason. I shuffle my knees on the slate, casting about for something to say that won't do any further damage to us. Percy closes his eyes and takes a deep breath, hands folded over his stomach. His black eye is starting to fade. In the darkness, it's no more than a shadow. "Nothing's different," I tell myself, but I can't quite believe it. We feel like changeling versions of ourselves lying here, bristle likenesses doing a mimic of the way they have seen us behave before. What if it happens again? It rises through my thoughts like shipwreck flotsam when I look at him. What if it happens right now? "Are you feeling well?" I ask him before I really think it through. He doesn't open his eyes. "Don't ask if you don't care." "God, Purse, of course I care. If you want me to say I'm fine so you'll feel better, I..." Definitely was hoping that would happen, I realize, and my stomach twists. I take another long pull, then say as the smoke slips out, "Give me a chance." Percy scrubs his hands along his breeches. "Fine, I feel horrid, I'm tired, and I'm sore all over, and the riding is making it worse, but if I say something, Felicity will get protective, and we won't be moving for days. I'm mortified you both had to see me like that. I haven't been sleeping well, and sometimes when I don't sleep it brings on fits, so I'm worried it's going to happen again. And every time I feel the least bit odd, I get panicked it's coming on, and then we'll have to hold everything on my account." He turns to me, his chin tipped up. "That's how I'm feeling. Aren't you glad you asked?" I can feel him shoving me away, but I hold my ground. "Yes."
Percy's face softens, and he turns away from me, his fingers working over his knuckles until they crack.
Sorry.
I draw another lungful of smoke, so deep I feel like my ribs are about to pop.
Does it hurt when it happens?
I don't know. I never remember it, thank God. It's awful afterward, though. And the head examinations and cold baths and the bloodletting and whatever else the doctors feel the need to do. God, it's miserable. My uncle hired a man to drill holes in my head to let the demons out, though that got squashed when he showed up to the house drunk.
Christ!
And none of it's helped. Not a thing. He laughs, then nudges me with his elbow. Here, you'll enjoy this. My uncle's physician told us I was having convulsive fits because I was playing with myself. That was an uncomfortable conversation. When I don't reply, he says, "You can laugh. I thought it was amusing."
"Please don't go to Holland," I say.
His mouth tightens and he turns away from me again. Against the sky, the stars crown him, marking the edges of his silhouette like he is a constellation of himself.
What am I supposed to do, Monty?
Just don't. Go back home and tell your aunt and uncle you won't. Or run away, stay abroad, or go to university and get a townhouse in Manchester and forget them.
Why wouldn't that work? Why can't you just go?
Well, think it through. My uncle won't fund a life beyond an institution, and the way I look, most places won't employ me without his reference. And I can't live alone for obvious reasons. Running isn't an option. Not alone, anyway.
He looks over at me quickly, then away again.
The smoldering end of my cigar crumbles, a fleet of falling stars between my fingers before they're extinguished against the slate. I think Mateo Robles is going to have something that will help stop your... You just haven't found it yet, but we will, and then you'll be better, and then you won't have to leave. Don't you want that?
I'd rather it didn't matter. It's not good, being ill, but I live with it. I wish my family cared for me enough to love me still, not in spite of it, or only if it went away. Maybe if they hadn't already had to deal with me being dark-skinned.
He presses his fingers into his chin, then shakes his head a few times.
I don't know. Doesn't matter. Can't change it, any of it.
I could say something to your uncle.
No.
Why not? If he won't listen to you...
I know you think you're being helpful when you say things like that, and when you defend me, and I appreciate it, I really do, but please, don't. I don't need you to stand up for me. I can do that.
But you don't.
You're right, sometimes I don't. Because I'm not the light-skinned son of an earl, so I haven't the luxury of talking back to everyone who speaks ill of me. But I don't need you to rescue me.
I'm sorry. It comes out soft and meek, like the bleat of a lamb. Percy looks over at me, his face veiled by the twilight and impossible to read. Then he folds his hand into a fist and presses it against my knee like a slowed-down punch.
Come here.
I'm here, I say, so quiet I almost don't hear myself.
Lie down with me.
My heart hurtles, beating like frantic wings against the base of my throat. I stub out my rolled tobacco and toss it off the roof, then stretch out beside him. My knees crack rather spectacularly as I go. The tiles are still sun-warmed, and I can feel the heat through my coat all the way to my skin. My head's higher than his, but we're close enough that I can see the freckles beneath his eyes. If I had to pick a favorite part of Percy's face, which would be impossible, really, but if held at gunpoint and forced to make a selection... It would be that small star map across his skin. A part of him it feels as though no one else but me is ever close enough to see. Percy shifts his weight on the tiles, sliding toward me in a way that I will myself not to be fooled into thinking is intentional.
Maybe someday you will be able to look at me and the first thing you think of won't be watching me have a convulsive fit.
I don't think of that, I say, though that's a lie. He must know it, too, because he says, "It's all right. I suspect it's a hard thing to forget." I press my head backward against the shingles, arching my neck.
"At least you'll never have to run an estate."
I realize what I've said as soon as it's left my mouth, and I fumble. "Wait, no, I'm sorry, that was...
Damnation, sorry.
That was a horrible thing to say.
Is managing your father's estate truly the worst thing that could happen to you?
Aside from the obvious things like famine and pestilence and losing my looks?
Yes. So maybe it doesn't seem like the best thing right now, fine. But someday you're going to want to settle down, and when you do, you'll have a home, and income, and a title. You won't want for much.
That's not really what troubles me about it.
So what is it? I feel suddenly like an even greater ass than before, for all the while I've spent moaning to him about my champagne problems, while he's being shipped off to a sanatorium. And yet here he is, lying beside me and pretending our futures are comparable.
Nothing. You're right, I'm very lucky.
I didn't say lucky. I said you won't want.
When I look over at him, he's still got his eyes on the sky. We're the inverse of each other, I realize. Percy desperately wanting to go home and not feeling he can. Me wanting to be anywhere else but with nowhere to go. Perhaps he can't understand it, the way that house will always be haunted for me, even if my father were gone from it. I can't imagine living in it for the rest of my life, throwing parties in its parlours and filling the cabinets with my papers, all the while ignoring the dark spot on the dining room floor that's never washed away, where I tore my chin open when my father knocked me to the ground with a single well-swung fist, or the hearth that chipped my tooth when I was thrown into it. There are bodies buried beneath the flagstones of my parents' estate, and some graves never green. I flick a scale of tobacco off my britches. Lucky me! Someday I will have everything my father does. Perhaps I'll even have a son of my own I can beat the shit out of.
If I ever see your father again, I swear to God I'm going to knock him out.
Ah, Purse, that's the sweetest thing you've ever said to me.
I mean it.
Hypothetically defending my honour, I'm touched. I close my eyes and press the heels of my hands against them until my vision spots. I shouldn't complain.
You aren't complaining.
He lets his head tip sideways so it brushes my shoulder, not quite resting there, but not quite not either.
You aren't like your father, you know that, don't you?
Course I am. A more imbecilic and disappointing version.
Don't say that.
All boys are their fathers. Looking at your parents is akin to seeing the future, isn't it?
Is it? He smiles. Perhaps that's how I'll know mine someday.
Better than a fiddle.
He raises his head. You're nothing like your father, Monty. For a start, you're far more decent than he is.
I'm not sure how, after all the terrible things I've done, he can possibly mean that. You might be the only person left on Earth who thinks me decent.
Between us, I feel his knuckles brush mine. Perhaps it's by chance, but it feels more like a question. And when I spread my fingers in answer, his hand slides into mine. Then everyone else doesn't know you.
Barcelona. 14. Barcelona is a walled city. Lean streets and tall houses interspersed with the skeletons of Roman ruins. A massive citadel sits along the marina, more ominous than the guardian presence of Notre Dame in Marseille. There isn't the traffic of Paris, but it's certainly a loud place and a bright one. The sun on the water is dazzling and the streets seem reflective, cobblestones flecked with muscovite that shines like glass. The shop fronts and awnings and even the ladies' dresses seem a brighter hue than we've seen elsewhere. It's not gilt like the finery in Paris, but it's vibrant, fresh-cut flowers rather than wax ones. We arrive on a sweltering day, the sun livid and the sky the hazy yellow of melted butter. The heat seems to pack tight between the walls and cradle the stones. Most of the people we come across speak French, mixed in with Catalan, which I recognize from the fair. Felicity does most of the talking. Pascal's grandmothers weren't wrong in their assessment that the Robleses are a known family. We only have to inquire after them twice before we're directed to their house in the Barri Gothic, the old quarter of the city with medieval structures masquerading behind classical facades. The house itself is less than I expected. For the manner of an old court family, the front is unimpressive. Grey with no adornment,
and so narrow it seems to have been squashed between the buildings on either side, with the excess oozing out the top. The portico is a mosaic of stone and brick, stunted balconies sprouting beneath the windows, and the railings chewed with rust. All the curtains are drawn. When I pull the bell cord, the waxed door smothers the echo of the chimes. Felicity looks up at the house, fine strands of hair stuck to the sweat glistening upon her neck. We're rather off the edge of the map now, aren't we? Don't be so dramatic. I look over at Percy. He's staring up too, though his gaze isn't as high as Felicity's. I follow his eyes and notice a death's head carved above the doorframe, thin, choppy lines intertwining into a bare skull flanked with feathery wings. Bolting suddenly presents itself as a very promising option, but I run my fingers along the edges of the box in my pocket and root myself on that stoop. I don't think anyone's, Percy starts, but the door swings suddenly open, and I am face to face with a woman probably a decade older than us. Long, glossy black hair hangs loose around her shoulders, framing her face, and her olive skin is stretched taut over a pointed chin and high cheekbones. Also a tight dress and fantastic figure, it's rather hard not to notice. I ruffle my hair on reflex. It must be a sight.
Buona dia, she says, stiff as starch sheets.
She's hardly got the door open wide enough for us to see her.
Us puc ayudar?
I was expecting French and I fumble.
English?
She shakes her head and suddenly she's speaking aggressive Catalan at me. I haven't a clue what she's saying, but I take it it's not friendly.
Wait, Felicity says behind me in French. Please, we only need a moment.
The woman starts to shut the door, but I thrust my foot out and catch it. She gives that no heed and keeps trying to slam it, which about folds my foot in half. But I manage to whip the puzzle box out of my pocket and thrust it into the narrow space between us. She freezes, her eyes widening.
Where did you get that?
She says, this time in English. It's hard not to be petulant to a woman who nearly amputated my toes with her entryway, so I say, a bit bolder than is likely wise,
Oh, that's odd. I didn't think you spoke English.
I feel someone poke me in the back, whether Percy or Felicity, it's difficult to say.
Where?
The woman demands. Unwedge my foot from beneath your door, and we shall tell you. We were told to give it to Professor Mateu Robles, Percy says from behind me. Could we see him?
He isn't here,
the woman replies.
Will he be back soon? Felicity asks. And could you let Monty's foot go? I'll take the box for him.
Felicity gives me a nod, like that's my cue to hand it over, but I don't let go. I'm a bit nervous the woman will slam the door in our faces as soon as it's in her grip, and we'll have no chance to speak to Robles.
We were told to give it to the professor. And we were hoping to speak to him, about some of his work with alchemy.
I don't know anything about that, she says.
Well, yes, so if we could speak to him,
he's dead. Which is just the rancid icing on a crumbling cake. I resist doing a rather dramatic flail of despair onto the doorstep.
Well, I am certainly glad we came all this way to find that out.
I try to yank my foot out from under the door, but the little bastard is really under there. I swear the woman is pressing harder to keep me pinned.
But if you'd like to speak to my brother, she says, he's here. Mateu was our father. I'm Helena Robles. The box belongs to my brother Dante now.
Yes, Felicity pipes up. That would be good, thank you. Helena opens the door fully, then turns on her heel and starts through the house, beckoning us after. I prop myself up on the frame so I can get a grip on my foot and try to rub the pain out.
I think she broke my toes.
She didn't break your toes, Felicity says. I stamp my foot hard against the ground a few times, then start to follow Helena. But Felicity makes a snatch at my arm.
Monty, wait.
Her expression alone says this is not a good idea. Percy says it too. He must have been backing up the whole time we were arguing because he's nearly to the street, his fiddle case held before him like a shield.
We found him, didn't we?
I say.
The professor.
Well, we found out he's kicked it. We're supposed to give it to him and he's not here, so we should talk to the son.
It makes sense.
Percy looks over my shoulder into the house. Yes, but...
Helena appears again, suddenly, like an apparition. We all three jump.
Are you coming?
I look back at the pair of them. They're both still staring at me like I've finally lost my mind.
Well, are you?
I ask. Felicity follows me. And with slightly more hesitation, Percy does too. The house is dark and narrow, thick drapes blotting out all the windows and giving the room an angled, smoky light. I was hoping for some relief from the heat, but the house is stifling. It's like stepping from the smithy into the forge. Helena leads us down the hallway, past a pair of armless classical statues, bodies wound into the twist of a swan's neck, and stops before a door at the end, another death's head etched into the baseboard. She reaches for the latch, then stops and turns back to us. She's eyeing the box in my hand rather intently, fingers coiling at her side like she'd like to get hold of it.
My brother does not do well with strangers.
I'm not sure what we're supposed to say in reply. It's not as though we're an imposition. We've brought the damn box back to them, after all, and a great personal risk, I'd like to add. They should be throwing gratitude and kindness and cream puffs at us, though I'd settle for just the cream puffs. Is there something you'd like us to do about that? I ask flatly. Felicity kicks the back of my foot. Helena puts a hand to her brow, then shakes her head.
I'm sorry, you simply... You've startled me.
We're sorry to intrude, Felicity offers.
No, you've done us a favor. We didn't think we'd see it again once it was... stolen, but don't be put off by Dante.
She cracks the handle and we file through the door after her. My foot catches on a loose floor cloth near the threshold, and I nearly pitch forward into her backside, which would make for a rather ungentlemanly impression upon our gracious hosts. Percy clearly doesn't learn from my error, for 3 seconds after I right myself, I hear him stumble. Beyond the door, we are enveloped by a thick incense smell that makes me want to bat at the air. The maroon-papered walls are almost entirely blotted out by things. There's no other word for it. 3 walls are shelves stuffed with books, interrupted by bell jars sheltering funguses, canopic urns, and gold-leafed death masks, and a stone trefoil knot that looks like it was recently dug up from some ancient ruins, red clay still clinging to its crevices. On 1 wall is a papyrus scroll bearing an etching of a dragon coiled in a circle, swallowing its own tail. Someone's scribbled eastern-looking characters in paint along a panel of the wainscoting, and an actual tombstone is resting against the desk. A heart-shaped locket hanging from its curlicues at first glance appears carved from obsidian, but upon closer inspection proves to be transparent glass filled with blood. Wedged into one corner of the room, behind a crystallophone so large it nearly obstructs him, is a man. A young man, I realize when he looks up, probably younger than Percy and me. He's thin, with a library pallor and a bookish stoop. Spectacles are jammed onto his forehead, and his arms are full of what appear to be scrolls covered in pictorial glyphs. He nearly drops them all when he sees us.
I'm so sorry.
He speaks French as well, with a bad stammer that bottlenecks his words.
Dante, greet our guests, Helena says.
She's behind us, one hand still on the doorknob, and the sensation of being trapped creeps up on me.
You should have... I could have... Why do you bring them here?
He thrusts the papyrus into an open desk drawer like he's trying to tidy up before we can get a good view of the mess, which seems a bit futile.
They've brought Father Baseggio's box, Helena says.
What?
Dante knocks his spectacles down onto his nose, only partly on purpose, I suspect, and clambers around the desk, tripping over the headstone in his haste.
You got it back? I mean, you found it? You have it?
I extend it to him, and he accepts, careful not to brush his fingers against mine, and holds it very close to his face.
Dante,
Helena says, sounding like a stern governess. He looks meekly to her.
I told them it's yours, as our father is dead.
His eyes go wide at her, then back at the box. Then he looks up again and seems to see us for the first time.
My God!
He doesn't look entirely happy about his reunion with the box any longer, a bit more shocked, with a shade of panic I can't fathom,
but that might be more due to our presence than to the delivery itself.
Thank you. I didn't think we'd see it. Thank you. Would you... Thank you. Can you sit down? Would you like to?
He kicks at a chair before the desk and a stack of books topples off. They land with their spines cracked upward and the pages spread, like birds shot from the sky. There are two chairs, and I take one, Percy the other. Felicity has become distracted by a cabinet near the door. It contains 7 ampoules in varying shades from basalt black to a pearled pink, like the inside of an oyster shell.
Don't touch those,
Helena snaps, and Felicity drags her hand back.
Sorry, I was interested in the compounds. Are they medicinal?
They are cure-alls,
Dante says, then goes fantastically red. He can't seem to keep his eyes on Felicity, even when she looks at him.
Panaceas being the scientific term, though they're not entirely.
My heart leaps. It couldn't possibly be this easy, could it? To be shown into the exact room and seated beside the substances we're looking for. But then Helena adds,
they're antidotes that work for most poisons. Activated charcoal, magnesium oxide, tannic acid, elephant tree sap, ginseng, tar water, and Atropa belladonna.
Dante clambers over a stack of crates and swings himself into the chair behind the desk. It's so low, and the desk so large, it looks as though he could rather comfortably rest his chin upon the tabletop. He pushes his glasses up his forehead, and they immediately slip back down and knock him on the nose.
They are our fathers. He was an alchemist.
Was he the author, Mateo Robles?
Felicity asks.
I went to a lecture on one of his books.
The same. He has quite a following.
Dante keeps his eyes on the floor and the box between his hands as we talk, all the while twisting the dials in an absent way that suggests it's a familiar habit.
Very sorry about the...
He waves his hand vaguely at the room.
It's all his.
Helena has edged around to stand behind her brother. Her eyes keep flitting down to the dials of the box as he turns them.
Did you come from far to bring this?
From England, Percy says, by way of France. We were on our tour, but we diverted to return the box to you.
And how did you come to be in possession of it?
She asks. Felicity and Percy both look to me, like they're giving me the choice of how honest I'd like to be.
I stole it,
I say, which comes out a bit blunter than it sounded in my head.
I didn't know it had any value,
I add quickly when the Robles siblings both look strangely at me.
I was just looking for something to steal.
Which certainly makes me sound benevolent. Then, to truly buttress the image I have painted of myself as gallant swain, I finish,
and we were coerced into returning it.
Percy, bless, comes to my rescue.
There are dangerous people looking for it. They were ready to kill us for its possession.
Neither Dante nor Helena looks particularly surprised by this news.
Likely the same men who stole it from us,
Helena says.
What's inside?
Felicity asks. If you don't mind. We were told about its make, but that's all. Dante sets the box on the desk, then immediately picks it up again. He looks to his sister, and they seem to conduct a silent conversation using only their eyebrows. Then Dante says,
we don't know.
Which is rather disappointing.
His work was panaceas, wasn't it?
I ask.
Is it anything to do with...
Our father had many theories, Helena interrupts.
Could we ask you,
I start, and Dante looks ready to answer, but Helena parries before he can.
His work died with him, she says. If you've read his book, you know as much as we do. We can't help you if you're looking for information.
My heart sinks, though her words are a bit too rehearsed for me to swallow them as sincere. And Dante's doing a shifty-eyed dance that would do him no favours at a card table.
Can you open it? Felicity asks. There's a cipher, a word that unlocks it.
Dante shakes his head.
He never told us. But thank you. Thank you for returning it. For bringing it back to us. It is... was... Sorry, it's so...
He pinches the bridge of his nose between his fingers, and I'm afraid he might start to cry. Then he looks up and finishes, dry-eyed.
Important to our father. So it's important to us. He told us to protect it, and we... But now you've brought it back.
He looks at Felicity, and she smiles at him. He goes positively vermilion. An uncomfortable silence falls between us. Dante kicks his legs against the chair like a boy, then says,
Well, it was very nice to meet you all. Oh, yes, we should leave you be.
Felicity stands from her perch on the arm of my chair, and Percy picks up his fiddle case, and for a moment it seems that our arduous journey is going to end in a single afternoon and a dead end. I can hardly bear to look at Percy for fear I'll crumple up at the thought of failing him. But then Helena says,
Don't be absurd. If you came all the way from France, you'll stay here, at least for tonight.
Oh, they don't.
Dante looks up at her, but she ignores him.
You've done us a great service.
She taps a finger toward the box, of which Dante still hasn't let go. It's the least we can do in return.
I don't think,
he says at the same time Felicity protests. We don't want to impose.
Just for the night,
Helena interrupts, sort of to both of them.
We can feed you and get you into some clean things and at least give you a proper bed. Do stay, please.
Felicity still looks ready to refuse, so I make a verbal hurdle between them. Yes, thank you. We'd love to stay. Felicity deals me a murderous look from the corner of her eye, just as Dante does the same to his sister. Helena and I both ignore our siblings. I'm not certain Helena's intentions toward us are entirely innocent, but I am certain mine aren't. I'm not convinced there's nothing in this house that might be of use to Percy, and if the sister won't tell us, the brother looks ready to collapse like poorly made furniture if pressed. And I'm keen to press. Helena gives Dante a little encouragement with the tips of her fingers on his shoulder.
Dante, could you show them above stairs?
Right. Yes.
He clambers to his feet, trips over the drawer he opened earlier, and catches himself on the edge of the crystallophone. The glasses clink together. It's an eerie, haunted sound.
Do you play?
Percy asks him. Dante goes red again.
No. It was...
Your father's?
Percy fills in for him.
Part of his collection,
Dante mumbles. What's a crystallophone have to do with alchemy? I ask.
Not alchemy. Death and burial practices. Before he died, he became quite obsessed.
Dante,
Helena says quietly, her tone a bowstring, drawing back a poison-tipped arrow. Dante dips his hand into the bowl of water and runs his finger along the top of one of the glasses. It releases a wobbling note, more vibration than sound.
There's a song, if played on the crystallophone, he says. It is believed to summon back the spirits of the dead.
15. The house is small, in spite of its height, and with the three of us added, there aren't enough beds. Felicity takes the only spare, while Dante gives Percy and me his apartments to share. A second-floor chamber with meager furnishings, and walls that may have once been red, but have faded to the coppery brown of blood dried into linen. He lends us each a set of nightclothes and a change for the morning, so we can let the garments we've been living in for a fortnight have a good soak. They seem likely to stand on their own when we shuck them. In spite of all the beds Percy and I have been sharing along the road, this is the first time we've slept alone together since we were home, and the first time I haven't had an excuse to not disrobe entirely for bed. I've never been shy about undressing in front of Percy, but suddenly the idea of it makes the entirety of my being blush. So I wait until he's occupied with the razor and the mirror before I strip quickly and put on my nightclothes. Dante's an average-sized fellow, so the sleeves of the dressing gown pool over my arms. I have to keep tossing them back like I'm raising my hands to conduct an orchestra. When Percy's finished, I take his place before the dressing table and tuck into my first proper wash in weeks, which is sincerely the most marvelous thing that's happened since those two ecstatic minutes of our kiss in Paris.
Did you think that was strange?
He asks as I stand at the mirror with my back to him, shaving. I can hear him shuffling about the room, making ready for bed. The light is very poor and the glass very spotted, and it's taking all my concentration not to accidentally slit my own throat with the razor, but I managed to reply, "What was strange?"
"I don't know. Helena and Dante, all of it."
"Think they've asked us to stay so they can smother us in our sleep because we know too much." I scrape a rim of soap off the blade and onto the edge of the basin. "I think they're holding out."
"How are they holding out? They don't owe us anything."
"I think they know what's in the box, or at least have an inkling. They both got shifty when I asked about the cure-alls. Whatever's inside, it must have to do with their father's work.
Perhaps he was trying to turn rocks into gold. That's alchemy too.
But that's not what we came for.
Perhaps that box is full of rock gold."
Behind me there's a flump as Percy drops his clothes to the floor. I catch the edge of my chin with the blade, and a glassy bead of blood rises to the surface of my skin. I press my thumb to it.
"I'm going to ask Dante tomorrow before we depart," I say. "About what?"
"About the cure-alls. He seems like an agreeable enough chap if you get him on his own."
I tip my head for a better view of my jawline, checking for patches I missed.
"Can't decide about the sister, though. She's a bit...
intense?"
"Well, yes, but she's gorgeous, which makes that intensity less repellent."
Behind me, Percy gives a laugh that's mostly a groan.
"Henry Montague."
"What? She is."
"I swear you would play the coquette with a well-upholstered sofa."
"First, I would not. And second, how handsome is this sofa?" Now Percy groans in earnest. I scrub the rest of the soap off my face.
"If you were half as pretty as me, darling, you might understand."
I turn, and the words crumble into dust. Percy's sitting on the bed, fiddling with a tinderbox on the nightstand and wearing nothing but a long shirt, which has gotten bunched up around his hips, leaving very little to my imagination. The neck hangs open so that the dusky light slides over the smooth skin of his chest, like oil on water. It is, perhaps, the most unfair play in the history of unrequited love. I take a step back without meaning to, knocking into the dressing table. The razor stone falls to the ground with a clatter. Percy looks up.
"I might understand what?"
"I..." And I can't stay here with him, let alone sleep next to him. Very suddenly, it's all too much to think of lying with him, chaste and distant, but with the sheets warm from his skin and his drowsy breath against my ear. I think it might eat me alive. I'm halfway to the door, my back against the wall, before I even realize I've moved. My hands are strangling the ties of my dressing gown. "I'm not going to turn in yet."
"What? Aren't you tired?"
"No, I think I'm going to see if I can find something to drink."
"Drink tomorrow. I want to go to bed."
It is impossible to explain how you can love someone so much that it's difficult to be around him. And with Percy sitting there, half in shadow, his hair loose and his long legs and those eyes I could have lived and died in, it feels like there's a space inside me that is so bright it burns.
"I'll try not to wake you when I come in," I say, as I unlatch the door behind my back, then slip out into the hall before he can say anything more.
The house is eerier at night, which I hadn't thought possible, but poor lighting and long shadows are masters of sinister ambience. I think about going back into the study where we met Dante, until I remember all the dead things and cursed objects there, and instead shuffle to the front parlour and settle in before the fire on a leather sofa which is just short enough that I can't stretch out all the way, and just stiff enough that I can't get comfortable, and I'm just irritated enough to know I won't sleep. There's a decanter on the sideboard with a bottle collar proclaiming it cognac, but no glasses, so I take a swig straight out of the neck. I haven't had a drink in a while, but it's not quite as soothing as I want it to be. There are footsteps in the hallway. Then, a moment later, a shadow blots the rug. "I thought I heard you wandering about." I sit up as Felicity makes a very unladylike flop onto the sofa where my legs just were. I offer her the cognac, and she shocks me by accepting it, then taking a delicate sip. Her nose wrinkles. "That's vile."
"It's not the best I've ever had, no."
"I don't think it's this particular vintage."
"It's an acquired taste."
"Why acquire a taste for something so horrid?"
Something flaps by the window, a black shape torn from the black sky, and Felicity and I both jump. Then we smile sheepishly at each other.
"This house is strange," I say.
Yes, but we're here, aren't we? They've been kind to let us stay. We haven't any other options.
She takes another tight-lipped sip of the cognac